Are you doing less than $5 million in revenue as an MSP? There's a buyer out there for you. Let's talk to Hartland Ross, who's a broker looking for businesses in that category, on this bonus episode of The Business of Tech. Hartland, thanks for joining me today.
Dave, excellent to connect with you again. It's been a little while, and always love jumping on these types of sessions, and looking forward to this one with you. So thank you very much.
The first question, the easiest one to always talk about is tell me a little bit about your journey and what you're up to now.
So we started as a marketing company for IT firms, and primarily back in the day, this was web hosting companies that we really ended up initially working with. And those firms ended up sort of evolving as we moved up the stack from simple shared hosting companies into more complex managed hosting and infrastructure, and through to data centers. And that sort of took us down the path to working with channel partners. Some of those channel partners were managed service providers. And some of those managed service providers also had their own data centers or were involved with managing infrastructure. And so we fast forward to today, are active with the managed service provider space, but of course still continue with our roots of managed service, or sorry, of the hosting space as well.
And you've been involved in a number of M&A deals. And tell listeners a little bit about what your role is in that space.
So we started over 20 years ago as a marketing firm, and we ended up generating a lot of growth for a lot of these IT firms. And over time, that growth became more and more expensive to do organically. Google was charging more, there was more competition, and so a lot of our clients were looking for ways that they could grow more quickly than they could organically, and less expensively than they could organically. And so the obvious choice was to look at buying other companies. And at the same time, we had groups who were interested in moving on. They were at burnout stage, or they had other businesses that they wanted to pursue and were interested in selling their customer base. And so as a result, we ended up getting clients who were asking us if we knew anybody who wanted to sell their businesses. But at the same time, we had other groups who were looking to move on and looking for someone to take over their customer base. And so the natural and obvious solution was to try to put these groups together. That was the genesis of our M&A practice. That was about 17 years ago. And now we have a very thriving M&A practice, again, focused on IT services, which is all we do. And it's marketed under the MSP broker and the hostbroker.com.
Are you working under a particular investment thesis when you're looking for firms for, you know, on behalf of your customers, or are they all individual differences? Tell me a little bit about the investment thesis behind it.
Yeah, so I guess from a high level perspective, we're really focused on the lower end of the market. So sub 5 million US in revenue, annualized revenue. And the valuation of the firm necessarily. So it's just a focus on kind of revenues of that size. Doesn't mean to say that we don't get opportunities that are larger than that, but primarily that's our wheelhouse. With respect to geography, MSPs is really a North American play. Hosting and infrastructure data centers is more of a global play. We've had groups from MSP space in other parts of the world, but really our main area of focus is going to be North America. In terms of like other specializations, whether it be a technology focus or whether it be industry specialization, really the reality is that there's just so many different permutations of IT firms, whether they focus on one industry or whether they have expertise in VMware, or they're a Microsoft shop, or Citrix, or they have specializations with Azure or something, AWS. I mean, there every one of these is a possibility, and for every one of these, there's a group that is interested. So we don't end up being too specific with respect to those types of specializations.
Now, firms look a lot different sub 5 million in revenue. And I was kind of thinking of this, is there a lower bound? And what does that look like for the low end? I mean, can you do deals as small for as providers of say $250,000 or $500,000? Or is there a lower bound to those deals and what you're looking for?
Yeah, so a good question. I was actually having this conversation yesterday internally. And the reality is that we don't have a hard cutoff. But I would say that less than a quarter of a million, we typically would end up helping somebody. And we frankly do this just to support the community more than anything. But in terms of being involved as a full service brokerage, start to finish, it becomes difficult for transactions that get down into the quarter million range. So how can we help rather than just turn somebody away and say, I'm sorry, but we can't help you. What we would instead do is, because there are absolutely groups that are interested in those types of opportunities, it's just how can we kind of most effectively support those groups. And what we do is we'll end up putting some kind of a reference in our mailing that we send out every week. So we have a list that we publish of companies for sale every week, almost without fail, goes out on Wednesdays. There's the odd time it may be delayed till a Thursday, but we'll put a note in our mailing where there's a reference to an opportunity that would have whatever the profile is, let's say it's a couple hundred thousand or 250, and that if anybody's interested to kind of reach out to us, and at that point we'll just put them in touch with the seller directly, and they can negotiate themselves, and we're not involved. But at least it solved that person's problem, because frankly, those numbers, it's hard for them to find groups, and I know that we can help them. It's just that we can't help them on a full service basis.
Now, everyone's dying to know, like, talk me through how you value the organizations, as part of the transaction. Like, what are the criteria, and how are you figuring that out?
Yeah, so for MSP specifically, they're valued as a multiple of adjusted EBITDA. Hosting, data centers, infrastructure providers can be valued differently depending on the size. And oftentimes it's actually a multiple of top line revenue. But with MSP specifically, it's a multiple of adjusted EBITDA. And those numbers, if it's a quick 30-second elevator conversation, the answer is it's going to be a 3 to 5x. Having said that, we've seen numbers that are below that the odd time, and certainly numbers that are above that. The reality is it's more of an art than a science, because there are a lot of factors that go into it. And I don't know, Dave, if you want to go into all those things, but obviously size of the business is going to be one very important element, arguably the most important, but also the nature of the customer base, recurring revenue, and a whole series of other aspects. And happy to chat about that if you'd like. It's just a little bit longer conversation.
Well, I'll tell you what, let me give you an example one, and you can sort of, I'll give you some numbers, and then you can give me some of the follow-up questions and how you might think about it. That way we can use an example to try and talk that through. So we're talking about a provider doing about, $1.4 million annually in top line revenue, right? And I'm going to estimate them running around 51% to the middle there when you take out the cost of goods sold, and they're keeping about 12%. At the bottom line. That's kind of we think that's a bit of an average provider rather than a best in class one. Of that, say doing about 160K a month in monthly recurring revenue.
Yeah. So, the first thing to do is to calculate adjusted EBITDA. And for those who aren't familiar with that term, and some are, but many aren't in the conversations that we have, what we're trying to do here is to remove some of these one-time expenses. So we've had groups where they said, oh, well, that legal bill for 75 grand, last year. That was because we had an issue with one of our employees. We had to pay some legal fees associated with fighting a wrongful dismissal issue. That is not something that is going to continue on in perpetuity. So we need to remove that because it's a one-time expense. Similarly, we might have, from a revenue perspective, we might have a disposition of hardware. All of a sudden, they had some excess hardware that they sold, or maybe even they sold a fleet vehicle or something. So all of a sudden, there's an income line of 30 grand, 100 grand. We've seen 300 grand. But that's not operational income. That's one-time kind of windfall of disposing of assets. So that needs to be removed. Back in 2020, we had to remove PPE loans. So that was another big element to be on the lookout for. And if you're looking back at a few years of financials, certainly be aware of that. If they were forgiven, it's fine, but it's not operational income. So we need to adjust for that. And then also any sort of personal expenses, people who are using their personal vehicles, personal cell phones, running their family through health plans, running a lot of their vacations or other extended trips through a meals and entertainment line item. So we need to adjust some of these things to come up with a realistic bottom line figure. And once we have that, then we multiply it by the multiple. I mean, in your case, the example that you just suggested here, now, I would suggest it's going to be north of 3, but certainly not going to be a 4. So payment terms are a big factor, right? So someone might tout that they got a 4x multiple, and what they didn't tell you is that 4x was paid over 10 years and had a huge earnout component to it. So with risk comes reward. And if there's a higher risk, then maybe they got a higher valuation, but it came with risk. So typically, for something like that, I would expect, mid threes, as a number, but it's hard to say. There's
going to be sure. Yeah, there's lots of variables to that. So you actually brought up my next question. Talk to me a little bit about what you're seeing in terms of typical payout terms, on the kinds of deals you're brokering right now.
Yeah, so there's really going to be oftentimes three components, right? The first one is the amount that's paid on close. The second is the amount that's funded by the seller, seller financing, which is the component that the seller is going to receive over some period of time. And both of those amounts are going to be guaranteed amounts. So the seller financed amount may or may not have an interest rate component to it. Obviously, interest rates are going up, and so people are asking a bit more about that. But generally speaking, it's a bit of a rounding error. You're better off to fight other battles around a higher valuation than to worry about whether it's 4%, 6%, 8% interest. Now, obviously, if it's over a long period of time, then it might make sense. But sometimes it's offered, sometimes it isn't. But those two components are going to be fixed, right? You're going to get those, assuming that the buyer ends up following through on their obligations associated with the purchase agreement, then you're going to receive those funds. The third piece is the earnout piece, which is to say, if the revenue is realized, then you as the seller will receive those payments. If the revenue is not realized, customers leave, there's churn, the revenue for whatever reason didn't exist in the first place, and of course that should be weeded out as part of due diligence, but those types of things get caught in the earnout. So the earnout is to say, look, we will pay you, whether it be a bonus or a percentage of revenue, we will pay you this amount subject to those customers, the revenue for those customers being realized, right? And so ultimately, on the basis that there's some expected value, there's an expectation that revenue will be realized. So, hey, if 2023 ends up looking similar to or better than 2022, we know what 2022 is going to be, or we will shortly in another short bit, then we're able to quantify what we expect 2023 to be. And then your valuation will have some expected amount to it. But the earnout is a ratchet mechanism or clawback, if you like, to have a safety net for the buyer. And most of the time, and particularly if the customers are on a contract, that revenue will be realized. And usually, it's based on the net effect of the revenue, not whether there's, hey, we lost a customer, therefore you're going to go down. Well, you lose a customer, but if you gain a customer, that offsets it. The buyer only is concerned about the net revenue retention. They're not concerned about a customer going in the door and another one coming coming through the door.
Now, are buyers looking to retain leadership these days? And what are you seeing in terms of those leadership retention requirements?
Yeah, so acqui-hire is the term that's often used, so acquiring talent. And I would say that that certainly has been in the last couple of years been a big driver for acquisition. Sometimes it's the main driver. Most of the time it's not the main, but it's a big plus. And in some cases will actually kill the deal. In other words, if the talent isn't coming with the deal, or the talent isn't there's no utility for the buyer in the talent that exists, the profile of the employees, the skill sets, the nature of them, they're US based or they're not, or whatever, that those criteria will be evaluated, and if it doesn't make sense, then someone may not go through with it. So it's historically been an important role, and of course the founder, the owner of the business may or may not stay on. If they don't stay on, then is there a team behind them that will be staying on, and how big is that team, and what are their roles, and are they the ones involved in the day to day versus the owner? I would say that we've been seeing a little bit less of that in the last probably most of 2022, but certainly in the last 6 months or so, I haven't heard that being referenced as much. And, you know, it's very anecdotal, and I'm not sure that I would run any experiments based on those results. But I think that it's probably a little bit indicative of the market now, where there's a little bit more selection from the perspective of buyers in terms of, hey, if I don't get the talent with this deal, I've got talent on my own team, or I can pick that talent up elsewhere now because of the way the economy's gone and some of the layoffs. So I don't think it's quite as significant in importance of deals that getting a deal done than we've seen historically. But I would say it's still an element. Yeah.
So we're recording in the back half of 2022. What's your take on the volume of deals in the acquisitions market right now?
Yeah, so this is a question that or a variation that I'm getting quite a bit recently as well, and I haven't seen anything to indicate that there's a slowdown at this point. There's still a lot of cash, in hand from groups that are looking to get deals done. What I have seen is groups that are reliant on external financing, and where particularly where they're having to pay debt financing and interest rates having gone up are putting a little bit of a dent into that. And so with interest rates going up, valuations are going to come down because there's only so much cash to go around to make the deal work with an ROI that's acceptable to the buyer. So we are seeing some groups bowing out with current rates. We're seeing other groups that are lowering their valuations as a result of the rates. However, there are still a lot of groups that are, have cash and are interested in getting a deal done. And so it becomes a supply and demand thing. And I think there's still enough demand for opportunities that, yes, there's a little bit less demand than there was, but I don't think it's putting pressure on pricing valuations just yet. However, I think that will happen as some of that cash is depleted, and depending on how long these higher rates are here, how long they stick around.
Now, you mentioned earlier that sort of valuation in the 3 to 4 times, and I know that a number of listeners are going to go, but I've heard numbers higher than that, 5, 6, 7, 8 times EBITDA on that. What are you telling those sellers that are the differences that create that level of valuation, or are they being completely unrealistic?
So, first of all, I think there's this idea of, as I said earlier, chest pounding, from an ego perspective, to be able to say that And, you know, I was offered this, or I got a deal done at this rate, or, you know, someone, a friend of a friend who's doing the same thing. And so someone, you know, hears some high number, and of course they're fixated on that. And no doubt there are probably deals that are being done at some higher rates. The questions that you as a potential seller and of course as a buyer, you're also concerned about this because you go, geez, well, I'm offering three and other people are offering five. Maybe I'm not competitive. Maybe I need to offer more. So, you know, I think that the first thing to do is just take a step back and say, all right, first of all, what are the terms of that deal? And chances are you don't know the terms of those deals because those aren't the things that people are talking about. What they're flouting is those high vanity metrics is the word I'm looking for. And what they're not talking about, as I said earlier, is that deal was done over 5 years, over 10 years, or has a significant earnout. And as I said earlier, with risk comes reward. So, hey, if there's more on the table, that I could lose, I could lose more, but I could also gain more. So if I'm willing to roll the dice on my business, and the buyer is putting forward a structure that allows me to do that, then hey, I might win big or I might lose. And so yeah, possibly someone won big, but they also could have lost. And that's the piece that you don't necessarily know. The other thing is that I would ask is, did the deal actually get done? I mean, someone may have made an offer. That doesn't mean to say that the deal got closed, right? It may have been just an offer and an LOI. Maybe it went into due diligence and broke apart. And sometimes people get fixated on, hey, as a seller, I got this one offer. It was really high. Deal didn't get done. But now when they're back on the market again, talking to the next groups, that bar has been set, at least mentally, to say, well, this is what now I'm looking for, right, as a minimum. And there are groups out there that are not that sophisticated. They'll put in high offers because either they don't know what they're doing or potentially if they have a little bit ulterior motives, they might have done that just to lock the deal down and then try to renegotiate it later. And so your expectations, have been set at figures that are frankly just not that realistic. And then you also just get groups, as I said a minute ago, they're just not that sophisticated and don't know what questions to ask, and are providing numbers that are not reasonable. And particularly if they try to go to a lender or an investor, are likely to not get done.
So if somebody's interested in having a conversation because they're interested in selling their MSP, what should they do to get ready and how do they get in touch?
Yeah, so look, you know, there's a lot of things that can be done to prepare the business. One of the fundamentals you'll see, doesn't matter what business you're in, is to clean up your financials, right? Clean up your, do some housekeeping, get your books in order and so forth. And so what does that actually mean? And there's kind of the ideal of what I would love to see and what some buyers would like to see. Then there's the practicalities of whether that's even possible. And so the first thing is to look at from your financials perspective, and that you've got your business broken down into the different components or business lines of revenue, lines of service. So hardware, for instance, has got one line. Managed services has got another line. And your kind of break, fix, project, consulting work has got another line, and that you know how much revenue is the recurring piece and how much is kind of everything else. And that then you have cost of goods sold that tie into that. So how many times do I look at a P&L and see that, geez, well, why are your COGS or your hardware, why does that figure exceed the value of the revenue that you're generating from hardware, right? And so, I didn't notice that. Let me look into that. And they find out that, well, there's an error. Someone booked some expenses into the wrong category, or maybe there was a timing issue and they didn't collect that revenue, or there's some of those equipment was used internally. There's a variety of different reasons that could account for that. But to clean up your books so that there's a relationship between your revenue and your cost of goods sold such that there's actually showing a margin. For those MSPs that are larger, they like to drill down and dig a little more deeply. And those groups typically have a higher operational maturity. And as a result, they're looking for a further granular breakdown. They're looking for profitability by service, right? So not just your managed services, but like within disaster recovery, how much are you making on that? How much are you making on your Microsoft your offering? What are the breakdown on your security, etc.? And then to further break that down, let's do it by client, right? So how profitable are we for each client and for each level of service? This is exceptionally rare to see for businesses that are certainly 3 million and under. Oftentimes we don't even see it on businesses that are 4 or 5 million in revenue, but sometimes it starts to creep in around 4 or 5 million. And it's not that easy to put in. So I wouldn't sweat it. You know, it's not an expectation of buyers. It's icing on the cake. But if you have that, these are the types of things that will certainly improve your valuation. There's more to it than that, but that's the financial component, which is a big piece.
So if somebody wanted to get in touch with you and talk, how do they do that?
Yeah. So look, happy to have conversations. We have quite a bit of content on our site and our blog as well. If you're interested in reading that, as well as our YouTube channel, you can reach out to me. I'm Heartland, H-A-R-T-L-A-N-D at thehostbroker.com. You can go to thehostbroker.com as well. And phone numbers on there were Pacific time. And happy to have a conversation with myself or any member of my team.
Well, thanks for joining me today.
Absolutely, Dave. Been a pleasure. And as always, and look forward to another one. And thanks for chime. I really appreciate it.
The Business of Tech is written and produced by me, Dave Sobel, under ethics guidelines posted at businessof.tech. Like the content? Support the show at patreon.com/MSPradio or buy our Why Do We Care merch at businessof.tech. If you want to reach our listeners, visit mspradio.com/engage.
Part of the MSP Radio Network.